Byrne dismissed all the charges against Ellsberg. Government misconduct, he stated, had incurably infected the prosecution. The next Monday, May 14th, Ruckelshaus announced that, as part of the administration's search for news leaks, 17 wiretaps in all had been ordered in 1969 to 71. The missing logs had been located. They had been in John Ehrlichman's safe in his White House office. Ruckelshaus did not disclose the names of the 13 government officials and 4 reporters whose phones had been tapped. The question was, who had authorized it? Woodward placed a direct call to a top FBI official. The official wasn't oblique. Some of the wiretap authorizations had come to the FBI either orally or by letter from Henry Kissinger. Incredulous, Woodward called a former FBI man. I know Kissinger gave some authorizations, he said. The White House switchboard put Woodward directly through to Kissinger's office. It was about 6 p.m. Hello, the familiar voice said in a heavy German accent. Woodward explained that they had information from 2 FBI sources that Kissinger had authorized the taps on his own aides. Kissinger paused.
It could be Mr. Haldeman who authorized the taps, he said.
How about Kissinger? Woodward asked.
I don't believe it was true, he stated.
Is that a denial?
A pause. I frankly don't remember.
He might have provided the FBI with the names of individuals who had seen or handled various documents which had been leaked.
It is quite possible that they, the FBI, construed this as an authorization. In possible individual cases, it is possible that I pointed out who handled what document to my deputy, General Alexander Haig, who in turn would have passed on the information to the FBI.
Woodward said that 2 sources had specified that Kissinger had personally authorized the taps. A brief pause.
Almost never, he said.
Woodward suggested that almost never meant sometimes. Was Kissinger then confirming the story? Kissinger raised his voice angrily.
I don't have to submit to police interrogation about this, he said.
Calming down, he went on.
If it is possible, and if it happened, then I have to take responsibility for it. I'm responsible for this office.
Did you do it? Woodward asked.
You aren't quoting me, Kissinger asked.
Sure he was, Woodward said.
What? Kissinger shouted. I'm telling you what I said was for background.
Woodward said they had made no such agreement.
I tried to be honest, and now you're going to penalize me, Kissinger said.
No penalty intended, Woodward said. But he could not accept retroactive background.
In 5 years in Washington, Kissinger said sharply, I've never been trapped into talking like this.
Woodward wondered what kind of treatment Kissinger was accustomed to get from reporters. Kissinger had an effective way of moving back and forth from anger to tranquility.
I talked in order to be helpful, he said next, and then angrily. What conceivable motive would I have had in granting you an interview?
Woodward said that he would check with the Post's diplomatic reporters to see if different rules about background and on-the-record conversations were observed.
You totally violated any procedure I've ever had with any reporter, Kissinger announced, and said goodbye.
Woodward consulted Murray Marder, the Post's chief diplomatic reporter. Did reporters usually allow Kissinger to determine, after an interview, whether it was going to be on the record, off the record, or only for background?
Well, yes and no, Marder said. Technically, Woodward was right, but most reporters who covered Kissinger regularly let Henry place statements on background after the conversation.
Half an hour later, Marder came by Woodward's desk to say that Henry had called him to complain bitterly about his interview with Woodward. Marder, Bernstein, and Woodward went into Howard Simon's office to discuss what had happened. Marder took a middle line, joking, Henry may blame the collapse of Paris negotiations on us. Simon's phone rang.
He picked it up, gave a few grunts, and switched the call to the speakerphone so everyone could hear.
"Tell the assembled multitude, Benny," Simon said.
It was Bradley, speaking from his home in a stiff German accent.
"What are you guys doing?" he asked. "I just got a call from Henry. He's mad."
Simons explained.
"You decide what to do," Bradley said. "I'll play reporter and read you what Henry said, and you can use it if it'll help."
Simons smiled.
"Is it on background?"
Kissinger, moving up the line from Martyr to Bradley, was doing what is known in diplomatic circles as hardening your position. His statement to Bradley was that it was almost inconceivable that he could have authorized the wiretapping.
"Almost inconceivable is not a denial," Woodward noted, and argued for the story.
But it was nearly 8, too late for the first editions. Simons decided to hold it a day. Woodward was angry. He felt the editors had waffled on the story because of Kissinger's position. Bernstein disagreed. The information from the FBI sources had come so easily. Perhaps they were part of an effort to shift responsibility from Haldeman and Ehrlichman to Kissinger. It was worth waiting a day to find out. As it turned out, though, the story could not wait a day. Cy Hirsch had it. A day later, he wrote in the Times that Kissinger had played a role in fingering some of his aides as possible leaks. Martyr did the story for the Post a day after that. Nearly everyone at the Post involved in reporting Watergate had reached a state of perpetual exhaustion. No one had been enthusiastic about a somewhat ambiguous story that would take a whole evening to coordinate and write. On May 17th, the Watergate hearings were scheduled to begin. During the preceding week, the reporters put together a long story that included details they had been collecting for months. The disclosure of the 17 wiretaps and the burglary of Ellsberg's psychiatrist were two more incidents in the pattern of White House vigilante activities deep-throated talk to Woodward about. The undercover work went back to 1969 and included these operations. The Secret Service had forwarded information on the private life of a Democratic presidential candidate to the White House. Senator Eagleton's health records had arrived in John Ehrlichman's office before they were leaked to the press. Haldeman personally ordered an FBI investigation of CBS News correspondent Daniel Shore in 1971. It added up to a broad campaign of illegal and quasi-legal operations. The account appeared on May 17th. The night of May 16th, on the eve of the hearings, Woodward set out for a meeting with Deep Throat. It would be the first since Haldeman and Ehrlichman had resigned, and Woodward figured his friend would be in a good mood. At their last meeting, Deep Throat had told him they could meet earlier, say about 11 p.m. Cabs were easier to find at that hour, and the trip didn't take as long as usual. But Deep Throat was in the garage when Woodward arrived. He was pacing about nervously. His lower jaw seemed to quiver. Deep Throat began talking almost in a monologue. He had only a few minutes. He raced through a series of statements. Woodward listened obediently. It was clear that a transformation had come over his friend. Woodward had dozens of questions, but Deep Throat held up his hand. "That's the situation," he said when he had finished. "I must go this second. You can understand. Be cautious." He stepped away and hurried from the garage. Woodward got out his notebook and wrote it all down. When he got back to his apartment a little after midnight, he called Bernstein.
"Can you come over?" Woodward asked.
"Sure," Bernstein said. At Woodward's apartment building, he rang the outside buzzer. Woodward met him at the elevator.
"What's up?" Bernstein asked.
Woodward put his finger over his lips to indicate silence. Bernstein wondered if Woodward had gone crazy, or if it was some gag. They walked down the hall to Woodward's apartment. Once inside, Woodward put on some music, a Rachmaninoff piano concerto. Bernstein noted what awful taste Woodward had in classical music. Woodward then drew the draperies over the large windows overlooking the city to the east.
At his dining room table, Woodward typed out a note and passed it to Bernstein. Everyone's life is in danger. Bernstein looked up. Has your friend gone crazy? He asked. Woodward shook his head rapidly, indicating to Bernstein not to speak. He typed another note. Deep Throat says that electronic surveillance is going on, and we had better watch it. Bernstein signaled that he wanted something to write with. Woodward gave him a pen. Who is doing it? Bernstein wrote. CIA, Woodward mouthed silently. Bernstein was disbelieving. While the Rachmaninoff piano concerto played on, Woodward began typing as Bernstein read over his shoulder. Dean talked with Senator Baker after Watergate committee formed, and Baker is in the bag completely, reporting back directly to White House. President threatened Dean personally, and said if he ever revealed the national security activities, that President would ensure he went to jail. Mitchell started doing covert national and international things early, and then involved everyone else. The list is longer than anyone could imagine. Caulfield, John J. Caulfield, a former New York City policeman, was a White House undercover agent and investigator. Caulfield met McCord and said that the president knows that we are meeting and he offers you executive clemency, and you'll only have to spend about 11 months in jail. Caulfield threatened McCord and said, your life is no good in this country if you don't cooperate. The covert activities involve the whole U.S. intelligence community and are incredible. Deep Throat refused to give specifics because it is against the law. The cover-up had little to do with the Watergate, but was mainly to protect the covert operations. The president himself has been blackmailed. When Hunt became involved, he decided that the conspirators could get some money for this. Hunt started an extortion racket of the rankest kind. Cover-up cost to be about $1 million. Everyone is involved. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, the president, Dean, Mardian, Caulfield, and Mitchell. They all had a problem getting the money and couldn't trust anyone. So they started raising money on the outside and chipping in their own personal funds. Mitchell couldn't meet his quota, and they cut Mitchell loose. CIA people can testify that Haldeman and Ehrlichman said that the president orders you to carry this out, meaning the Watergate cover-up. Waters and Helms, Richard M. Helms, and General Vernon A. Walters were the director and deputy director of the CIA, and maybe others. Apparently, though this is not clear, these guys in the White House were out to make money, and a few of them went wild trying. Dean acted as go-between between Haldeman Ehrlichman and Mitchell LaRue. The documents that Dean has are much more than anyone has imagined, and they are quite detailed. Liddy told Dean that they could shoot him and or that he would shoot himself, but that he would never talk and always be a good soldier. Hunt was key to much of the crazy stuff, and he used the Watergate arrests to get money, first $100,000, and then kept going back for more. Unreal atmosphere around the White House, realizing it as curtains on one hand, and on the other trying to laugh it off and go on with business. President has had fits of dangerous depression. Bernstein sat down at the table, smoking a cigarette. He had been told that week by one of his Justice Department sources to watch out for surveillance. He and Woodward motioned to each other about leaving the apartment and going for a walk. In Woodward's hall, they stopped and decided they had better tell someone. Who? Woodward asked. Bernstein said that they had better go straight to Bradley. Now, Bernstein said. It was after 2 a.m., they got into Woodward's car. They decided not to talk in the car, either. Several blocks from Bradley's house, they called him from a payphone. He says, come over, Bernstein said. The reporters had never been to Bradley's house, and they had wondered how the boss lived. The streetlights created a half-dark atmosphere. As they approached the porch, a barking dog charged out. A man stepped out of the dim shadows. It was Bradley, his hair combed, his voice and eyes sleepy. "Come in," he said, and the three stepped into a comfortable living room filled with books and rustic antiques. Woodward passed Bradley a copy of the memo. Bradley began reading and started to ask a question. The reporters both stopped him and asked that he finish reading first. Bradley finished and looked up. "Let's walk outside," Bernstein suggested. Bradley gazed bemusedly about his living room, and then he stood up and walked out the front door. The three moved into the center of the small yard. The chill was biting. None of them wore a coat or sweater. Bradley said with a touch of mockery that it was unlikely that his front yard was bugged. "What the hell do we do now?" he asked. Bernstein suggested mobilizing a group of reporters to check out each item on the memo. Woodward suggested that the Post hire private detectives to help. They spent half an hour on the front lawn, bouncing around to keep warm, reviewing Deep Throat's statements. Bradley said he had never seen anything like this before. Skeptical, but shaken, he said that the problem was no longer just journalistic. He mentioned something about the state and the future of the country. He said he would call a meeting of key editors and reporters the next morning. It was Bradley who seemed to be prolonging the discussion, repeating himself and letting the reporters repeat themselves. None of his usual impatience showed. "Okay," he said finally, looking at Woodward. The reporters left at 4 a.m. They had no idea whether Bradley thought the early morning visit was called for. The next morning at the office, Woodward and Bernstein passed copies of the memo to Simons, Rosenfeld, and Sussman, gesturing that it should not be discussed in the office. Just before noon, Bradley called a meeting on the Post's roof garden outside Mrs. Graham's office. Bradley, Simons, Rosenfeld, Sussman, National Editor Richard Harwood, Bernstein, and Woodward sat around a large wrought-iron table under an umbrella. Harwood found the entire story implausible. His questions indicated concern that the Post's Watergate coverage was nearing the edge of fantasy. Bradley said that he wasn't interested in the logic of it. "We've seen some pretty illogical things in the last year." He just wanted to find out what might be true. The meeting ended inconclusively. Bernstein and Woodward had a lunch appointment with one of Dean's associates who they thought might know about some of the information they had received. They met him in a relatively remote restaurant, and over a long, leisurely lunch, he confirmed most of the major points in the Deep Throat memo. According to type notes of the discussion, the source didn't think RMN Nixon used the word jail when he threatened Dean on national security, but confirms the conversation took place, and the president made it clear, in the strongest terms, that he wouldn't stand for Dean revealing undercover activities. Dean was very shook after that meeting. But he confirmed that Dean believed Senator Baker was in the bag and helping the White House, and that Hunt was blackmailing the White House. Beginning in February, RMN began dealing with Dean directly. By then, blackmail scheme well into effect and stakes rising. RMN in one meeting asks Dean how much the total price will be for silence, asks for an estimate. Dean says $1 million, and the president says it can be accommodated, that there would be no problem getting the money. Doesn't think as much as $1 million already doled out, that being the figure for the whole package. Bradley called another meeting in a large vacant office in the old remodeled portion of the Post building. The same group gathered behind a glass panel, which looked out on the desks of the style section of the paper. The editors and reporters paced back and forth as Bernstein and Woodward described what they had learned at lunch. It was the most concrete evidence so far that the president knew about the cover-up and was a willing participant. Harwood shifted gears. He thought the story was important and should run. Bradley and Simons were nervous. "This was new to us," Simons said later. We had been told that our offices might be bugged, that lives could be in danger. Anyone who could do that might consciously set us up on a story. There was no reason to rush. It would be 2 weeks before Bernstein and Woodward wrote about Dean's allegation concerning the president's involvement in the $1 million estimate of the cover-up cost. And 2 weeks more before they had confirmed and written the story that Howard Hunt had blackmailed the White House. But in the following months, almost all the items on the Deep Throat memo appeared in the public record as a result of the work of news organizations, the Senate committee, and statements from the White House. For several days after Woodward's meeting with Deep Throat, Bernstein and Woodward behaved cautiously. They conferred on street corners, passed notes in the office, avoided telephone communications. But it all seemed rather foolish and melodramatic, so they soon went back to their normal routines. They never found any evidence that their telephones had been tapped or that anyone's life had been in danger. At the trial in January, the Justice Department had contended that low-level officials like Gordon Liddy were the moving forces behind the Watergate conspiracy. The first hint that Justice was considering the president's involvement came during a lunch with a high department official in May. In the week before the president's April 17th announcement, the official told Bernstein, the prosecutors had informed Assistant Attorney General Peterson that they were on the verge of indicting several of the president's closest aides, present and former. The prosecutors had insisted that the president be told personally of the impending indictments. Peterson did so. The prosecutors had expected the president to announce the resignations of Ehrlichman and Haldeman immediately. Instead, he had resisted for almost 2 weeks. They had asked that he order the cooperation of members of his staff. It never came. The prosecutors had been confused and disturbed about the president's actions ever since. In late May, Bernstein talked about this on the phone with another Justice Department attorney. He had decided that the best way to get at it was to suggest that the department was going easy in its investigation. Why wasn't it dealing with allegations against the president? What makes you think we aren't? The lawyer replied angrily. We know that your theory of the case is a closed conspiracy that ends with Haldeman, Bernstein said. You just showed me you don't know it, the attorney said. He paused. If you're taking notes, that is not saying one way or the other. Then you're investigating the president? Come on, you're not going to get me to answer that. Bernstein listed some of the evidence against the president. You don't know what you're talking about, the lawyer said impatiently. Evidence has nothing to do with it. Talk to some lawyers. What does the Constitution say about the president? Think about it. Can he be indicted? Even assuming one had a case that showed he was guilty of obstruction. Bernstein asked why the prosecutors were unwilling to call the president before the grand jury. Who said they wouldn't? You haven't, Bernstein said. Talk to some lawyers, the attorney said disgustedly. Bernstein did that, and when he finished, he understood what had happened. The question of the president's involvement had been discussed at some length in Justice. Attorneys researching the problem had come to believe that the Constitution precluded the indictment of an incumbent president. If the president couldn't be indicted, the lawyers reasoned, he couldn't be called before a grand jury. Bernstein went to a well-placed source who said, there is no bombshell tucked away. There is an evidentiary pattern raising questions about the president's role. Bernstein suggested to another Justice Department attorney that if it had been anyone other than the president, such a pattern of evidence would have meant that person would have been called before the grand jury. The attorney agreed. Working with a Justice Department phone directory, Woodward found a lawyer in the criminal division who said, the Watergate investigation has run smack into the Constitution. We must now deal with the question of how the president can be investigated. Bernstein went back to the angry attorney who had first suggested the constitutional problem. Of course the president can't be called, he stated, and of course it would be justified. That was the prosecutor's view, too, he added. The story was headlined, Prosecutors Say Quiz of Nixon Can Be Justified. The White House was outraged. Ziegler said the president would not testify before the grand jury or the Senate committee because it would be constitutionally inappropriate and would do violence to the separation of powers. The Post story, Ziegler said, recounted a shocking and irresponsible abuse of authority on the part of federal prosecutors. Grand jury proceedings are by law secret. The White House asked Attorney General Richardson and Harvard Law Professor Archibald Cox, who had been appointed special prosecutor in May, to find the sources for the story. If an investigation was ever opened, the sources were never found. The first week of June, Bernstein was talking to a source he hadn't called for several weeks. He asked if there had been any other burglaries. There was one proposed, but I don't think it ever came off. The Brookings Institution. John Dean turned it off. Bernstein called Dean's associate. "I'm not sure you have the right word, friend," he said. "Somebody must have misspoken himself. Chuck Colson wanted to rub two sticks together." Maybe Bernstein's mind was jumping too fast. Colson wanted to start a fire? "You might say that." "It couldn't have been serious," Bernstein said. "Serious enough for John Caulfield to run out of Colson's office in a panic. He came straight to John Dean, saying he didn't ever want to talk to that man Colson again because he was crazy, and that John better do something to stop him before it was too late. John caught the first courier flight out to San Clemente to see Ehrlichman. That's how serious it was." "Why Ehrlichman?" "Because he was the only one with enough influence to stop it at that point. And he wasn't happy to see John Dean. Dean wasn't supposed to know about it. But once he flew out there to make a big deal about it, E didn't have any choice but to shut it down. John stayed in the room and listened while E called Colson. The whole time he was on the phone, E just glared at him like he was a traitor." Dean's associate explained the purpose of the operation to Bernstein. Morton Halperin, Daniel Ellsberg's friend, whose telephone was among the Kissinger taps, was believed to have kept some classified documents when he left Kissinger's staff to become a fellow at the Brookings Institution, a center for the study of public policy questions. The White House wanted those documents back, and since security at the institution was too tight to risk a simple burglary, it was conjectured that a fire could cover a break-in at Halperin's office. Bernstein located someone who had heard the whole story from Caulfield. "Not just a fire bombing," the man said. "That was what Colson thought would do the trick." Caulfield said this has gone too far, and that he didn't ever want anything to do with Colson again in his life. Both Dean and Caulfield had told the story to investigators, he said. Woodward was afraid it might be a setup. Bernstein checked his sources again and the investigators. "Absolutely solid," he told Woodward. "A firebombing." Woodward then called Colson.
"There's no question about that," Colson told him. "There was one mistake. It wasn't the Brookings, but the Washington Post. I told them to hire a wrecking crane and go over and knock down the building, and Newsweek also."
Woodward said that he was serious. The allegation was deadly serious and not a joke.
"It was the Washington Post, I'm telling you. He had an explicit assignment to destroy the Washington Post," responded Colson, his tone perfectly straight. "I wanted the Washington Post destroyed."
Woodward didn't doubt it, but he said the allegation about the Brookings Institution was going into the paper.
"Explicitly," Colson replied, "it is bullshit. I absolutely made no such statement or suggestion. It is ludicrous. The story you have told me is a flight of fantasy, the outer limits. This one has gone too far."
He called Woodward back several hours later.
"Are you serious about this story?"
Woodward said that he was. Colson's tone was altered.
"I was asked about this by the federal prosecutors. I was aware that there was a discussion about how to get highly classified documents back. There is always a possibility that I might have said it. It is characteristic of me, but I never made it, and certainly never meant it.
The story ran on June 9th. About a week before John Dean testified before the Senate committee in June 1973, Woodward was talking about Howard Hunt with a Senate attorney. The attorney felt that Hunt held a key to still more undercover work. Hunt had been brought to Capitol Hill from jail for long interviews, and he had disclosed an instruction he claimed to have received from Colson about an hour after Alabama Governor Wallace was shot. Hunt said Colson wanted him to fly to Milwaukee immediately and break into Arthur Bremer's apartment, the attorney said, and bring back anything that might help in connecting Bremer to left-wing political causes. Wallace had been shot by Bremer in a Maryland shopping center on May 15, 1972, at about 4 p.m. By 6:30, a Post editor had learned the name of the would-be assassin from White House official Ken Clausen. Clausen had said that it was clear from literature found in Bremer's dingy Milwaukee apartment that the assassin was connected to leftist causes, possibly the campaign of Senator George S. McGovern. Woodward had been working on the story, and he had rejected the idea. There had, in fact, been both left-wing and right-wing propaganda in the apartment. But several reporters from Milwaukee had told him they had been permitted to enter Bremer's apartment during a 90-minute period right after the shooting in Maryland. Many reporters had carried off papers and other effects. Two reporters from Milwaukee papers had told Woodward that they had gone into Bremer's apartment after FBI agents had been there once and left. An hour and a half later, the agents had come back and sealed off the apartment. The FBI had never offered any explanation as to why they had permitted Bremer's belongings to be looted. Back in late 1972, before the first Watergate trial, Howard Simons had summoned some of the editors and Bernstein and Woodward into his office. "You know, there's one thing we've got to think about," he had said, "the ultimate dirty trick." Bernstein and Woodward had mentioned it to each other more than once. Woodward had had an anonymous call saying that one of the Watergate suspects had gone to Milwaukee to meet with Arthur Bremer, and it had been rumored that Bremer was carrying $100 bills while he was stalking Wallace. Simons wanted the rumors checked. Woodward and Bernstein had been skeptical, and Simons had agreed. But as he pointed out, many once unthinkable things had occurred. The reporters never found any evidence to substantiate a connection between Bremer and the suspects. Months later, a Post reporter went to Milwaukee, but he, too, turned up nothing. Now Woodward was being told that Colson had ordered Hunt to break into Bremer's apartment. The next morning he called Hunt's attorney, William O. Bittman. "There is no question that there was testimony about that," Bittman said. "Colson asked him, Hunt, to go to Milwaukee and go into Bremer's apartment. I don't have a clear recollection of the reason why he was to go out there. I don't recall whether the word break-in was involved." About 4 that afternoon, June 19, 1973, Woodward went to Colson's law office to see David Shapiro, Colson's law partner and his chief legal advisor for Watergate matters. The new law firm of Colson and Shapiro had offices in a modern building a few blocks from the White House. Shapiro greeted Woodward heartily, offering him a thick, chubby hand and an overstuffed light brown leather chair. "It was ridiculous," Shapiro said, "even to think that Colson would do such a crazy thing." A bespectacled young attorney in the firm named Judah Best was brought in by Shapiro to meet Woodward. In less than 2 months, Best would get a new client, Vice President Spiro T. Agnew, and would successfully bargain Agnew's office away to keep him out of jail. Best told Woodward it would be unfair to write a story even mentioning such a flimsy allegation. Working his hands heavily, Best frowned and grimaced as he maintained that Howard Hunt was under pressure and clearly unstable. Shapiro and Best worked on Woodward for about 45 minutes, trying to plant the seeds of doubt. Shapiro then went to his desk, called his secretary, and instructed her to tell him to come in. Moments later, the door opened and in came Colson, wearing blue pinstripe pants, dark blue shirt, and blue polka-dot tie.
He had a gigantic pot belly. He looked wounded and tired as he shook hands with Woodward. He didn't say much, but just stared at Woodward.
"You can't do this to this man," Shapiro said, standing behind his desk.
Coulson said nothing. He looked like he was about to weep. There was none of his usual overbearing manner.
"You're out to destroy him," Shapiro said.
Woodward said he was not out to destroy anyone.
"Come on, you can admit it," Shapiro said.
The lawyers argued that it would have been illogical for Coulson to order Hunt to burglarize Bremer's apartment because Coulson was in close contact with the FBI that night. They said Coulson had urged the Bureau to make a speedy, thorough investigation.
"Would it have been logical for me to push in the FBI and simultaneously order Hunt to Milwaukee?" Coulson asked.
Woodward figured the tape recorder was going, and he chose every word. He remarked that the Watergate case was already crowded with illogic.
"The charge is absolutely untrue, and I'll swear it's untrue under oath," Coulson said.
Coulson seemed hurt by Woodward's unwillingness to accept his statement as definitive proof. Woodward recorded Coulson's denial in his notebook. Shapiro then produced copies of a report about a lie detector test Coulson had voluntarily taken that vindicated him of complicity in the Watergate bugging. Woodward was also handed a memorandum for the file, dated June 20, 1972, the day the Post had first identified Howard Hunt as a suspect. Memoranda for the file are often called cover-your-ass memos. The one handed to Woodward with the subject heading Howard Hunt said in part,
"I talked to him, Hunt, on the telephone the night Governor Wallace was shot, simply to ask him for his reactions and what he thought might have been the cause of the attempted assassination." Hunt was known as something of an expert on psychological warfare and motivations when in the CIA. In a covering memo, Coulson had noted, however, "I cannot be sure that my memory is all that precise."
Shapiro gave Woodward two more memos, unrelated to the Coulson-Hunt-Bremer story. One was dated October 11, 1972, the day after Bernstein and Woodward's major espionage sabotage story. The memo was written by Ken Clawson and addressed to Coulson. Referring to the mention of his name in connection with the Muskie Canuck letter, Clawson had written that he would spend the second Nixon administration paying back the Washington Post. The other memo indicated that Haldeman had tried to blame Coulson, not Clawson, for authorship of the letter. Woodward asked for copies of the two memos on the Canuck letter. There was a long silence. Woodward repeated his request. Another silence. Then one of the lawyers said something about being able to work out something, and Woodward would be able to get copies in the near future. Were they offering a deal? It wasn't explicitly stated, but the suggestion of a trade was in the air. What would happen if Woodward said there would be no story on the Bremer allegation? Would one of the attorneys say it would then be possible to let him have copies of the memos? Maybe Woodward was listening for it, because he was pretty certain that this was the way Coulson did business. Woodward wanted to turn off any such suggestion. He said it sounded like something was being offered, but that he knew it wasn't. All three spoke at once.
Of course they wouldn't think of that. They would never do that. It would be an insult to think so or imagine so.
Woodward saw how they operated. If he hadn't been listening for it, he wouldn't have realized that a trade had been offered. This is the way bribes must work, Woodward thought, so that only someone listening for it would hear it. He couldn't test the situation. If he were to step close to a deal, they could destroy him. Shapiro and Coulson started grinding on Woodward again. That was the price he had to pay, Woodward guessed. He had to listen. Maybe there was a reason. Maybe he would be convinced. He got in a question occasionally.
"Why were you in touch with the FBI so much?" he asked Coulson.
"The president was agitated and wanted the political background on Bremer," Coulson said. Informed of the shooting, the president became deeply upset and voiced immediate concern that the assassin might have ties to the Republican Party, or even worse, the president's re-election committee. If that were the case, Colson noted, it could have cost the president the election. The meeting with Shapiro and Colson had taken almost 2 hours, and there wasn't time to get the story into the paper that day. Just before deadline, the following evening, Woodward called Shapiro and told him that the story was going. Woodward had promised to let him know. Later that night, Colson called Bernstein to protest. The allegation was an utterly preposterous one, he insisted, and added that he did not believe that it could be an accurate report of any testimony that the Senate committee has received. Bernstein told him it was accurate. Even if it accurately reflected Hunt's testimony, Colson said, it would be irresponsible to print it, because Hunt had been under great duress when he met with the Senate committee. Bernstein said he would include Colson's observations in the story. Colson played heavily on what he described as Bernstein's civil libertarian instincts, pleading with him to keep the story out of the paper. When Bernstein said no, Colson called him a vicious hypocrite. Since June 17, 1972, the reporters had saved their notes and memos, reviewing them periodically to make lists of unexplored leads. Many items on the lists were the names of CRP and White House people who the reporters thought might have useful information. By May 17, 1973, when the Senate hearings opened, Bernstein and Woodward had gotten lazy. Their nighttime visits were scarcer, and increasingly, they had begun to rely on a relatively easy access to the Senate committee's staff investigators and attorneys. There was, however, one unchecked entry on both lists, presidential aide Alexander P. Butterfield. Both Deep Throat and Hugh Sloan had mentioned him, and Sloan had said, almost in passing, that he was in charge of internal security. In January, Woodward had gone by Butterfield's house in a Virginia suburb. No one had come to the door. In May, Woodward asked a committee staff member if Butterfield had been interviewed. No, we're too busy. Some weeks later, he had asked another staffer if the committee knew why Butterfield's duties in Haldeman's office were defined as internal security. The staff member said the committee didn't know, and maybe it would be a good idea to interview Butterfield. He would ask Sam Dash, the committee's chief counsel. Dash put the matter off. The staff member told Woodward he would push Dash again. Dash finally okayed an interview with Butterfield for Friday, July 13, 1973. On Saturday, the 14th, Woodward received a phone call at home from a senior member of the committee's investigative staff. "Congratulations," he said. "We interviewed Butterfield." He told the whole story. What whole story? Nixon bugged himself. He told Woodward that only junior staff members had been present at the interview, and that someone had read an excerpt from John Dean's testimony about his April 15th meeting with the president. The most interesting thing that happened during the conversation was very near the end, Dean had said. He, Nixon, got up out of his chair, went behind his chair to the corner of the executive office building office, and in a barely audible tone said to me he was probably foolish to have discussed Hunt's clemency with Colson. Dean had thought to himself that the room might be bugged. Butterfield was a reluctant witness. He said that he knew it was probably one thing that the president would not want revealed. The interrogators pressed, and out floated a story which would disturb the presidential universe as none other would. The existence of a tape system which monitored the president's conversations had been known only to the president himself, Haldeman, Larry Higbee, Alexander Haig, Butterfield, and the several Secret Service agents who maintained it. For the moment, the information was strictly off the record. The reporters were again concerned about a White House setup. A taping system could be disclosed, they reasoned, and then the president could serve up doctored or manufactured tapes to exculpate himself and his men. Or, having known the tapes were rolling, the president might have induced Dean, or anyone else, to say incriminating things, and then feign ignorance himself. They decided not to pursue the story for the moment. All Saturday night, the subject gnawed at Woodward. Butterfield had said that even Kissinger and Ehrlichman were unaware of the taping system. The Senate committee and the special prosecutor would certainly try to obtain the tapes, maybe even subpoena them. Kissinger doesn't know, Woodward reflected. Andy thought, Kissinger probably knows almost everything. And he wouldn't like the idea of secret taping systems plucking his sober words and advice out of the air, whether for posterity or some grand jury. How will foreign leaders feel when they learn of hidden microphones? Woodward thought about knowing something that Kissinger didn't know. Ziegler was also in the dark, apparently. Woodward called Bradley. It was about 9:30 p.m., and Bradley sounded as if he might have been sleeping. Woodward outlined Butterfield's disclosures. As he read, his voice tripped several times. Maybe he was overreacting. Bradley was silent. "I just wanted you to know," Woodward said, "because it seems important. We'll go to work on it if you want." "Well, I don't know," Bradley said with slight irritation. "How would you rate the story?" Woodward asked. "B plus," Bradley said quickly. "B plus," Woodward thought. "Well, that isn't much." "See what more you can find out, but I wouldn't bust one on it," Bradley said. Woodward apologized for calling on a Saturday night. "No problem," Bradley said cheerfully. "Always glad to hear what's up." They hung up. Woodward concluded that he'd been too anxious. The Senate committee moved quickly. On Monday, on national television, Butterfield reluctantly laid out the whole story of the tapes before the Senate committee and the country. "Okay," Bradley said the next morning. "It's more than a B plus." Chapter 17. In the first week of November, Woodward moved the flower pot and traveled to the underground garage. 2 weeks earlier, the president had fired Special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox, who had subpoenaed 9 presidential tape recordings. Attorney General Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus, his deputy, had resigned. In the shattered inner circle of the White House, the president's aides were saying that the special prosecutor had been fired because the president feared that Cox was going to prosecute him. Then, with Cox gone, the president bowed to public opinion and a court order and surrendered 7 of the tapes. 2 had never existed, his lawyer said. Deep Throat's message was short and simple. 1 or more of the tapes contained deliberate erasures. Bernstein began calling sources at the White House. 4 of them said they had learned that the tapes were of poor quality, that there were gaps in some conversations. But they did not know whether those had been caused by erasures. Ron Ziegler told Bernstein there were no gaps or erasures in the tapes. A story that asserted the opposite would be inaccurate. Bernstein proposed that the story could be held if Ziegler would pledge on his honor that he was absolutely sure. "We deal in facts, not honor," Ziegler replied. The story quoted anonymously Deep Throat's remark that there were gaps of a suspicious nature which could lead someone to conclude that the tapes have been tampered with. On the afternoon of November 21st, Ziegler phoned Bernstein back. The president's lawyers had announced in Judge Sirica's courtroom that one of the tapes contained an 18-and-1/2-minute gap. "I'm giving you my word that I didn't know about this when we had our other conversation." Bernstein and Woodward did not disbelieve him. They knew from a number of sources that the president had refused for months to let any of his White House aides listen to all of the tapes, even while he was claiming that their full disclosure would vindicate him. Richard Nixon, his subordinates were saying, had become a prisoner in his own house, secretive, distrustful even of those who were attempting to plead his cause, combative, sleepless.
One of the men who had been closest to him throughout his presidency told Woodward helplessly. The only people he would talk to candidly about Watergate are Bebe Rebozo and Bob Ablanalp, the millionaire businessmen who were his longtime personal friends. At Disney World in Florida, the president told an audience of editors on national TV, "I am not a crook." On December 28th, General Alexander Haig, the White House chief of staff, reached Katherine Graham by telephone in a Washington restaurant. He was calling from San Clemente to discuss two of the reporter's stories on the Post's front page that morning. The first said that Operation Candor, the name given the campaign by the president to defend himself, had been shut down, and that two of the president's most trusted advisers, who had steadfastly maintained his innocence, were no longer convinced of it. The second story said that the president's lawyers had been supplying attorneys for H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman with copies of documents and other evidence that the White House was submitting to the special prosecutor's office. Haig characterized the stories as scurrilous, accused the Post of disservice to the nation, and appealed to Mrs. Graham to stop publishing such accounts. Haig himself, the reporter soon learned, had come to doubt the wisdom of the president's course. For more than 6 months, he and Henry Kissinger had been urging the president to cut his ties with the three former aides who had been closest to him, and were now the primary targets of the special prosecutor's investigation, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Colson. Instead, the president had built his legal defense in concert with the three, and had continued to meet with them and talk with them on the telephone. During the summer of 1973, Kissinger had tried to persuade the president to disavow his former aides publicly and to accept a measure of responsibility for Watergate. The suggestion had been angrily rejected by Ron Ziegler. "Contrition is bullshit," he had responded to the presidential speechwriter who brought him Kissinger's recommendation. By late February 1974, the Special Watergate Prosecution Force had obtained guilty pleas from Jeb Magruder, Bart Porter, Donald Segretti, Herbert Kalmbach, Fred LaRue, Eagle Krogh, and John Dean. Eight corporations and their officers had pleaded guilty to charges of making illegal contributions to CRP. In Washington, Dwight Chapin was under indictment for perjury. In New York, John Mitchell and Maurice Stans were on trial, charged with obstruction of justice and perjury. On March 1st, the Washington grand jury that had indicted the original conspirators and burglars of the Democratic National Headquarters in 1972 handed up its major indictments in the Watergate cover-up case. It charged seven of the president's former White House and campaign aides with conspiracy to obstruct justice. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson, Mitchell, Strachan, Mardian, and lawyer Kenneth Parkinson. A week later, a second Washington grand jury handed up indictments in the conspiracy to burglarize the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. Those charged were Ehrlichman, Colson, Liddy, and three Cuban-Americans, including Bernard Barker and Eugenio Martinez, who were among the original Watergate break-in defendants. Acting for the full House, to which the Constitution gives the sole power to impeach, the House Judiciary Committee had begun the first investigation in more than 100 years into such possible action against a president. The chief Watergate grand jury turned over to Judge Sirica, in addition to the seven indictments, a briefcase containing a report and the accompanying evidence of what Deep Throat and others assert to be a staggering case against the president. Since the prosecutors had argued strongly that the Constitution precludes the possibility of indicting an incumbent president, the grand jury recommended that both be turned over to the House committee. On January 30th, the president had delivered his annual State of the Union message to a joint session of the House and Senate, the justices of the Supreme Court, and the members of the cabinet, as well as to other guests and a national TV audience. "1 year of Watergate is enough," he declared at the conclusion, and he implored the country and the Congress to turn to other, more urgent matters. To those who will decide if he should be tried for high crimes and misdemeanors, the House of Representatives, and to those who would sit in judgment at such a trial if the House impeaches, the Senate, and to the man who would preside at such an impeachment trial, the Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger, and to the nation, the President said, I want you to know that I have no intention whatever of ever walking away from the job that the American people elected me to do for the people of the United States.
All the President's Men was written by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and read by Richard Poe. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Bedita Chaudhary. All the President's Men was produced and directed by Claudia Howard. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. All the President's Men is available in paperback from Simon & Schuster. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Obama's Wars and The War Within, A Secret White House History, written by Bob Woodward and read by Boyd Gaines.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.